Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers.
Just a reminder that this podcast is intended to be purely educational and is not meant as medical advice. Any patient information has been modified to protect the patient's identity. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers.
Enjoy the show!
Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solvers, to another schema episode. I'm Maddie, and I'm joined with Jack, Charmaine, and the newest member of the schema team, the one and only Yusuf. Yusuf does so much within CP Solvers, from management reasoning to VMR leadership to so much more. Yusuf, I just feel so lucky to learn from you constantly on CP Solvers, and we're so excited to have you a part of the schema team. So welcome.
Woohoo!
Do you want to introduce yourself? Maddie.
Yeah, thank you, Maddie. Thank you, everyone. Very excited to join this team. I've been listening to this podcast for so many years now, and extremely honored to join this team. I've been part of the academy for the past year. I'm currently a resident and going into hospital medicine. I'm very, very excited to join you all.
We are so excited to have you. This is going to be awesome. It's Charmy, by the way. How's it going, Jack?
Things are good. Yeah, it's good to be back. Excited to be with a new team, and most importantly, excited for us to get to chew on a case together today. Really looking forward to it.
All right. Well, let's jump right in. I have a really interesting case that I'm excited to discuss with you all. This is a case of a 32-year-old man who is presenting to the emergency department with 4 days of pain and swelling in his left knee and left ankle. So the story is that 2 weeks prior to presentation, he reported burning with urination and some purulent urethral discharge. Then 4 days prior to presentation, he developed left ankle and knee pain. And the left ankle pain in particular was intolerable when he went to work, making it very difficult for him to stand and do his job. The pain slowly worsened over the next 3 days and was accompanied by swelling of both of those joints, which ultimately prompted him to come to the emergency department. So, Jack, what are your initial thoughts on this information?
I am excited to be in a familiar space, not with somebody this young, not a familiar age to come through the walls of a VA, but this is a clinical syndrome that we get the chance to see a lot over at the VA, which is one of joint pain. And I think there's a couple different ways that we can initially start to analyze this case. I think initially on the individual's chief complaint, we see that they are experiencing joint pain. And we could characterize that as arthralgias. And arthralgias could be from a variety of things. It could be from an acute arthritis, as well as from a systemic illness that's manifesting with joint pain. I recently had an upper respiratory infection, and when I stood up in the morning, I felt some arthralgias in my low back, hips, and knees. But luckily, unlike this patient, I did not have any acute swelling or very, very aggressive pain at those sites. And the reason that that's important is that the description that Maddie gave us here, when we hear that there's pain and swelling localized to specific joints, it sort of upgrades us from the arthralgias DDX, which is very vast and wide, to the arthritis DDX, which is still vast and wide, but a little bit narrower. And there's a number of dimensions through which we can analyze the arthritis. I think the two biggest variables are going to be, one, the specific joints that are involved, but more importantly, the number of joints that are involved. So you could think of it as a spectrum. A single joint, we call a monoarticular arthritis. Several joints, we call an oligoarticular arthritis. And many joints, we call a polyarthritis. I am not one who is skilled enough to say where the hard lines in the sand are of when one becomes several and when several becomes many, but we can really sort of think of it as a spectrum, right? The more joints that are involved above one, the more we move from oligoarthritis to polyarthritis. And in this case, Maddie gave us two, which is anywhere somewhere between one and several joints here. I prefer to keep things as simple as possible. And so when I see two joints that are involved, particularly when they're sequential in nature, right? We have the knee and the ankle. If I go back to kindergarten, I remember that the knee bone sits above the ankle bone. And so those seem like they're joints that are close together. So in my mind, this all kind of collapses into a single area of the body that has inflamed joints. And so for this, I'm sort of just going to rely on or draw from the monoarticular arthritis DDX. And there's really four major categories of disease that we can think about for the monoarticular arthritis. We can have septic arthritis. And if you only remember two diagnoses underneath septic arthritis, the organisms I want you to remember are disseminated gonococcal infection and Staph aureus. The former is more common in younger individuals around age 35 or younger, and the latter is more common in older individuals. Now, both are possible in a variety of different age ranges, but those ages can help frame our probabilistic judgment. After septic arthritis, we're going to think about crystalline diseases, and this could be gout with uric acid crystals or pseudogout with calcium pyrophosphate crystals. Those two make up the vast majority of the acute monoarticular arthritis with the red, hot, swollen, inflamed joint. Far below that, we start to see some of the autoimmune diseases coming in. And the two that I want you to remember are the two RAs. The first is reactive arthritis, and the second is rheumatoid arthritis. Now, you may be saying, Jack, wait a second. I've always learned rheumatoid arthritis as a polyarthritis. And you would be correct in that, in making that judgment. But there are some times where rheumatoid arthritis can present as a single joint, or there's one joint that becomes inflamed as the disease is moving to other joints. And so while it's uncommon for RA to do it, it still can do it. The more common autoimmune disease to cause this particular pattern is a reactive arthritis, which is usually a post-infectious arthritis that develops after a GI or a GU infection. And so in this case, we have to ask ourselves, well, is there any signal outside of the joints that can help us better understand whether this is a septic arthritis, a crystalline disease, or an autoimmune inflammatory arthritis? And Maddie gave us some important information, which is that there has been some recent purulent urethral discharge. And you may be saying, oh, great, urethral discharge, burning with urination. This sounds like actually a post-GU reactive arthritis. We're done here. But actually, we need to put our attention towards evaluating for disseminated gonococcal infection first. Disseminated gonococcal infection, in addition to being very common, can be quite destructive and corrosive to the joints that are involved. And so in this, we sort of have to hedge our bets and say the GU symptoms may be a signal for disseminated gonococcal infection, or they may be related to a recent GU infection that could be setting off a reactive arthritis. Of course, gout and pseudogout also deserve our respect here, but that would sort of be how I would be framing this case here. So to zoom back out, focus your analysis of arthritis based on the number of joints involved from a spectrum of one, a monoarticular arthritis, to a few, oligo, to many, poly. In this case, we have two. To keep things simple, we're going to treat it like it's a monoarticular arthritis. And the categories of disease to remember are septic, crystalline, and autoimmune. If all of those come back negative, we may attribute it to osteoarthritis, but that's a hard argument to make in only a 32-year-old gentleman in this case. So the first three are going to occupy the bulk of our cognitive energy here.
Absolutely beautiful discussion. All right, let me give you all some more information. So in terms of review of systems, no other joints were swollen or painful to him. He did not have any lower back pain, and he did not have any vision complaints or red, itchy eyes. No fevers, chills, night sweats, chest pain, shortness of breath, skin changes, or oral lesions. In terms of his past medical history, he reported that 3 years prior, he had an episode of gonococcal urethritis that he received and completed treatment for. He also reported that he had a history of a remote traumatic injury to his left knee. This was about 15 years ago, he said. He said that he dislocated this left knee when he was playing basketball. He said he did not have a fracture and that he wore a brace for many months. He says that since this time, he has had these chronic intermittent flares of knee soreness that self-resolve, always of this left knee. And he describes his current left knee pain as different from his usual intermittent knee soreness. His ankle pain, though, he says this has never occurred before to him. He has no past surgical history, does not take any daily medications, and no allergies. His family history is unremarkable. And in terms of social history, so he works in a restaurant in California as a chef. He says that he does long shifts up on his feet when he's standing. And that's actually why this ankle pain was really bothersome to him at work. He says he is sexually active with three different female partners over the last 6 months, and he does not report using protection. He says that he does not have consistent alcohol and no drug use. So in terms of the exam, for vitals, he was afebrile. His heart rate was in the 90s. His blood pressure was 120s over 80s, and he was sating well on room air. In general, when I went to go see him, he appeared uncomfortable, but not in acute distress. His oropharynx was clear, and there was no lymphadenopathy. Cardiovascular exam, no murmurs, and there were regular heart sounds. For lungs, they were clear to auscultation. His abdomen was soft and non-tender. On GU exam, there was purulent urethral discharge. And then for the extremity exam, so both the left knee and the left ankle were swollen and both had erythema. Both of those joints were warm to touch. And for both the left ankle and the left knee, there was pain with passive flexion and extension of the joints. No other joints had erythema or swelling. And as I mentioned in review systems, there was no back pain and no focal deficits on neuro exam. So Yusuf, I'll pass the mic to you to hear your thoughts on how the past medical history kind of moves the needle on some of the differential diagnoses that Jack outlined.
Thank you, Maddie, for this rich aliquot. So when I'm tackling joint pain, my initial approach is to try to localize the lesion. If the pain occurs in active but not in passive motion, I think of the periarticular structures, such as the bursa or a tendon. But if the pain, similar to this case, occurs with passive motion, I consider the etiology to be in the joint. And I use the pathophysiology to help me think about the source of the pain. One of the most morbid diagnoses and the no-miss diagnosis in this case would be septic arthritis. And seeding of the joint can occur via contiguous spread, such as a cellulitis or an ulcer. It can occur via direct inoculation, such as via injections or surgery, or through hematogenous spread, such as IV substance use, indwelling lines, or catheters. The risk factors include host risk factors and exposures to certain organisms. For example, having prior joint disease, such as rheumatoid arthritis, crystalline disease, or prosthetic joint, increases the septic arthritis. And we know in this case, the patient had a history of trauma to the joint. Another thing would be exposure to certain organisms, such as sexually transmitted infections and tick-borne illnesses like Lyme disease. In this patient, the current and prior exposure, possible exposure to sexually transmitted infections, along with the trauma, increases the risk of septic arthritis. Given that that is a no-miss diagnosis, the burden of proof would be on us to rule out septic arthritis, and a arthrocentesis would be paramount to rule out this diagnosis.
All right, Yusuf, ask and you shall receive. So for the CBC, the white count was 10.9, and the hemoglobin and the platelets were within normal limits. The basic metabolic panel was also within normal limits. The CRP was 106. And for the arthrocentesis that you requested, there was 21,000 white blood cells in this arthrocentesis. 85% were neutrophils. There were no crystals, and the Gram stain was negative. At this point early on, the culture and the gonorrhea nucleic acid amplification test was still cooking. So Charmaine, I'll pass the mic to you to hear your thoughts on this arthrocentesis.
Thanks, Maddie. I love to go through the data. So just starting from the top, you know, with the CBC white count of 10.9 and with the CRP that is elevated, it just kind of points to, you know, the general inflammatory state that we were suspicious of to begin with. And then, as Yusuf mentioned, what we want really, really is arthrocentesis. So let's think through it. Whenever I think about synovial fluid analysis, I think about a couple of different categories. I think about whether it would be hemorrhagic, a non-inflammatory. Usually with non-inflammatory, we often think about less than 2000 white blood cells. And you can see the non-inflammatory category includes like a meniscal tears to OA, which is osteoarthritis that Jack mentioned. And the last category would be inflammatory. So this is the part that our no misdiagnoses are in. We often see the synovial fluid have more than 2000 white blood cells. Your septic arthritis or crystal induced arthritis are in this category. So hemorrhagic, non-inflammatory, and inflammatory. Looking at this data, 21,000, we are in the inflammatory category. Let's see if we can make more progress than that, especially looking at 21,000. In general, the more white blood cells you have in your synovial fluid, the more concerned you are about septic arthritis. So the bigger number, the most concerned. So if this was 100K, 80K, you're more worried about septic arthritis. The lower numbers make septic arthritis a little less likely, but it does not eliminate it. Couple of caveats to remember. One is the amount of white blood cells you have in a joint is also a function of a host, right? If you have an immunocompromised host, you might not get the elevated numbers. Thankfully, we don't think we're in this category. The other thing to remember, as Yusuf mentioned, if you have a prosthetic joint, then we have lower thresholds, because what happens with prosthetic joints? They tend to be sticky. As Jack mentioned, staph is one of the bugs we worry about. So we have a lower threshold. So even a bit of white blood cell count in the joint, we worry about prosthetic joint infection. Thankfully, we don't think this patient is immunocompromised, and we know he doesn't have a prosthetic joint. So let's see if the other data can help us. There's no crystals, which makes the crystal-induced arthropathy a little less likely. But gram stain is positive. It's really helpful, right? We're like, damn, we know there's a bacteria there, we're going to treat for it. However, again, a negative gram stain in a right clinical context, it might not be reassuring. So you want to wait for your culture results to come back. So what about this patient? The one thing that Jack mentioned that we're worried about is a disseminated gonococcal infection. So we should think about this entity in anyone who's sexually active individual who has arthralgias. It most often presents with acute purulent monoarthritis. And if people have skin lesions, it helps to make that higher on your differential. Just to add a little bit more of a challenge for us, people who have purulent monoarthritis from gonococcal infections, cultures are not always positive. Less than 50% of cases, the cultures are positive. Because what? This bug, it really likes to hide. And they tend to have lower white blood counts in their synovial fluid, oftentimes similar to our patients, around 20,000. That number has been observed in the gonococcal arthritis. And that's why we often send the nucleic acid amplification testing to help us diagnose gonococcal arthritis. So where are we at in this case? We have a gentleman who is coming in with sexual risk factors and knee tap that is concerning for an inflammatory arthritis. Given the concern for gonococcal infection, I would personally treat this patient for a septic joint until proven otherwise. So for the first 24 to 48 hours, I would add vancomycin ceftriaxone. Because again, 21,000, all impressive, not as impressive as septic arthritis, but we're worried about gonococcal. So I would treat until the cultures, if it's negative, and when the gonococcal testing comes back negative, then you can think more about reactive arthritis. But again, your no misdiagnosis come first.
That was absolutely brilliant, Sharmina. I love the way that you frame that, because I think it really highlights one of the challenges about the management in these situations, which is how do we make informed management decisions amidst all of the pieces of clinical uncertainty that you mentioned, right? Up front, there's the inherent uncertainty with awaiting culture results from a synovial fluid analysis. But even as time goes on, right, we could see negative culture results, and there still is disseminated gonococcal infection. We may not be able to get adequate sampling from the other mucosal sites to further frame the probability for or against disseminated gonococcal infection or other infections that can cause aseptic arthritis. And so when we're navigating tensions in these moments, I think it can be compelling to say, oh, I want to make a clinical decision that I think is going to be right. But one of the alternative ways that I try to frame these decisions is actually asking myself, if I'm going to be wrong, what direction do I want to be wrong in? In other words, how do we make a safe bet or at least hedge our bets, knowing that the uncertainty is going to be inherent to the problem at hand? And if I think about this specific scenario, asking ourselves, which direction do I want to be wrong in? I want to be wrong in treating the septic arthritis that gets falsified later on, then missing and failing to treat the septic arthritis that is brewing. Right? Not only is that potentially a disease that, as Yusuf mentioned, could disseminate further into the body and localize to other sites, but it can be devastatingly destructive to the joints where we already are seeing pathology. And thinking about a person of any age, right, the ankle joint and the knee joint are critical for functional status and mobility. And so in this case, amidst the uncertainty, right, until we really feel like we can formally falsify the disseminated gonococcal infection hypothesis and the other causes of septic arthritis, the wisest decision to make is to keep the antibiotics on until we feel like we can argue ourselves out of continuing them, rather than saying, we're not sure which one it is. It could be reactive arthritis. Let's wait to start the antibiotics. And so I think in this case, vanc ceftriaxone, and we can all breathe some sigh of relief while we await the culture results. And then in terms of the question about imaging that sometimes comes up in these cases, I will say imaging is sort of a part of the management script for monoarticular arthritis or oligoarthritis, but I can't say it's a prominent feature. And I think one of those reasons is the fact that while advanced diagnostics like MRI are incredibly good at detecting some of the findings that could be present within the joint space, it's hard to definitively say what the etiology of those findings are, because many of those inflammatory arthritides, septic, crystalline, even reactive or autoimmune arthritis, they can all have very similar findings. They can have synovitis. They can have erosions. We may see edema in the surrounding soft tissues of the joint. And so I think of imaging as being helpful for confirming the presence or absence of inflammation in and around the joint, but potentially less helpful for definitively telling us what the etiology is. Of course, there are certain extreme findings that we may see, like extensive destruction of the joint space or extensive loss of bone, that could increase the probability of an infection in that space. But I think, as Charmaine was saying, we're really trying to make the best possible judgment based off of the synovial fluid analysis and then the targeted culture data as well.
Jack and Charmaine, thank you so much for the teaching. When I was in medical school, I had this magic number of 50,000, and it was this cutoff where above 50,000 it's positive and below 50,000 it's negative. But in preparation for the session, a rational clinical exam paper says that a white count more than 50,000 has a positive likelihood ratio of 7.7, but a negative likelihood ratio of 0.42. That means that it's very helpful in ruling in disease if it's more than 40,000. But if it's less than 50,000, it doesn't necessarily rule out the disease. So I thought that was very helpful for me as well.
I love it when numbers back our reasoning. Thank you for mentioning that, Yusuf. That's super helpful.
All right. Amazing discussion, you all. So I'll give you some more data here. So as Charmaine recommended, the patient was started on empiric vancomycin and ceftriaxone. And we have further arthrocentesis results. So the culture and the gonorrhea nucleic acid amplification test from the synovial fluid returned negative. In terms of some other data, so the urine chlamydia test returned positive. And as a result of this, he was started on doxycycline. The urine gonorrhea test returned negative, and the gonorrhea and chlamydia throat and rectal swabs were also negative. Blood cultures were negative, and an HIV and RPR were also negative. To the question of imaging, imaging was done of both the ankle and the knee. And for the ankle specifically, an initial ultrasound showed thin fluid collection. So because of that, the team progressed to do an MRI of the ankle. And the radiologist did comment on some signal in the navicular bone that was possibly consistent with osteomyelitis. And imaging of the knee was done, and the radiologist commented on signal in the patella, also possibly consistent with osteomyelitis. However, our team went down to review this with radiology, and in our discussion with the radiologist, they made it clear to us that this finding was actually described as equivocal and not clearly indicative. And for the knee, the signal change was thought to be related to the patient's chronic knee syndrome. So in light of all this data, Jack, I'm curious how you're thinking of the diagnosis in this patient.
Oh, this is an intense question here, Maddie. I will say to answer this question, I'm actually going to take off my doctor hat for a little bit of time and actually put on a different hat, which is the hat of a lawyer. Because I think the lawyers can help us in situations like this, because when we're making decisions in the case of uncertainty, what we're really trying to do is to make a case for one management decision over the other, or make a case for one diagnosis over the other, right? And if we look at now the sort of cumulative sum of data that we have, we can ask ourselves a question: what case can I make for disseminated gonococcal infection? We can still make some case, but that case has been drastically weakened by the sequential negative studies that we have back here. The culture from the synovial fluid coming back negative helps us, but as Charmaine was saying earlier, doesn't clinch the case that this isn't disseminated gonococcal infection. But if we look at the cumulative sum of evidence, right, we don't see the rash characteristic of disseminated gonococcal infection. We have negative synovial fluid testing. We have negative nucleic acid amplification testing from several other mucosal sites. By no means do these 100% take DGI off the table, but they dramatically reduce the probability of it, right? So our ability to make a case for a disseminated gonococcal infection is much weaker. If we look at the other ones in our schema, right, the case for crystalline diseases is reduced dramatically by the absence of crystals on the synovial fluid and the presence of another alternative competing hypothesis, which is reactive arthritis. So now we have to ask ourselves about the other case that we're trying to make. Can we make a case for reactive arthritis? And I think we can start to make a very strong case for that, right? If we think about the tempo of reactive arthritis, what I want people to upload into their illness script is that usually reactive arthritis develops weeks or so after a GI or a GU infection, like Campylobacter in the GI tract or chlamydia, and there are many, many others. So we have a compatible organism with a positive chlamydia, a compatible tempo of disease in terms of a couple weeks after the dysuria, we're seeing arthritis emerge, and an exclusion, like we said, or I should say a relative exclusion of other alternatives. We haven't seen Staph aureus or other common pyogenic bacterial organisms grow. We haven't seen DGI pop up here. And so overall, right, if we were in a courtroom here, right, we could make a stronger case for reactive arthritis than we can for DGI. And so in light of that, I think thinking about, okay, let's think about transitioning our treatment to focus more on reactive arthritis than DGI and other infectious arthritides. We're doing that while keeping in mind the possibility that we could be wrong. So this isn't the patient where we would dust our hands off and say, all right, I'll see you in 6 months. This is the person who, if we decide to stop antibiotics, we're checking in with them relatively consistently. How are your symptoms progressing? How are things unfolding? Are you continuing to get better? Because if this individual fails to progress as we would expect someone to progress after we stop antibiotics, well, all of a sudden we have to revisit the case that we made because the evidence has started to work against us now. So putting back on the doctor hat, I think we can start to make a strong case for reactive arthritis. But again, doing that while holding the uncertainty that is always going to be inherent in this case until the patient completely gets better.
Spot on, Jack. And I hope you don't leave medicine, but if you need to become a lawyer, you know, you would be great at that too. So exactly as you said, Jack, the working diagnosis or the final diagnosis for this patient was post-chlamydia reactive oligoarthritis. And as you mentioned, he was treated with supportive care with NSAIDs primarily, and then also the doxycycline for the chlamydia infection. To comment a bit on the imaging findings I talked about, so when we were having the same debate in our minds of reactive arthritis versus could this potentially be disseminated gonococcal infection, the MRI signal changes mentioning osteomyelitis at the patella of the knee and possibly the navicular bone of the ankle, it was challenging to interpret, and it prompted the team to consider DGI. So there was some diagnostic uncertainty between DGI and reactive arthritis when the gonorrhea studies were still pending. When all of the gonorrhea studies returned negative, the presumed diagnosis was reactive arthritis. And when I reviewed the patient's chart, he followed up with his outpatient provider and he reported full resolution in his left ankle and his left knee pain, and there was no longer any swelling. So he ultimately did really well. So amazing discussion, all of you. And I'll pass the mic to you, Yusuf, to share some teaching points on reactive arthritis.
Yeah, so reactive arthritis is considered to be part of the spectrum of the spondyloarthritides, and it can be associated with HLA-B27. Like Jack mentioned, it's associated with multiple GI and GU organisms, including chlamydia, gonorrhea, ureaplasma, campylobacter, and so on. And in addition to an oligoarthritis, it can actually be associated with enthesitis, sacroiliitis, and even aphthous ulcers and conjunctivitis. It's a diagnosis of exclusion, and it's mostly by excluding other morbid diagnoses like septic arthritis and other causes of oligoarthritis. The mainstay of treatment is NSAIDs and the treatment of any associated infection, if an infection is found. And that's all I had for today.
Amazing summary, Yusuf. I want to emphasize a teaching point that you made earlier, Yusuf, because it was a learning point that really stuck with me as I was working with the team caring for this patient. And that is the principle that prior damage to a structure, whether a joint or a valve, lowers the threshold for seeding of infection of that structure. I was reflecting on this and realized that there are many diseases that demonstrate this principle. For example, damaged heart valves or prosthetic valve make the valve at risk for infection to seed, leading to endocarditis. Prior back injury can predispose to seeding of infection in that location in vertebral osteomyelitis. And in this case, the patient's prior traumatic knee injury likely placed that knee at risk for post-chlamydia reactive arthritis in this case. Well, that's a wrap, everyone. Charmaine, Jack, Yusuf, I learned so much hearing you discuss this case, and we will see you all on the next Schema episode.
That's a wrap, folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
If you like this episode and want more from the Clinical Problem Solvers, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter that includes episode recaps, teaching points, and educational graphics.
And if you'd like to join us live, check out our daily virtual morning reports, where we come together as a global community to discuss cases and learn together. For more information and instructions for signing up, check out the link in the episode description.
See you next time.